We are on the final lesson in our series, Fighting Shadows. And so it was one of those things that it's longer than what we typically do, but it's been good. But honestly, now that I'm at the end, I'm kind of like disappointed because I wanted to do more. But this is the last one. And I wanted to open with this statement. We live in a culture that prides itself on activism while simultaneously failing to find purpose and meaning in our individual lives. We gather as collective voices for a cause, but we find nothing in which to give ourselves and our lives to. In general, we are apathetic in our daily lives, stuck in a limbo as we wait for the next bandwagon to jump onto. So today, our lesson is called this, the shadow of apathy. And what I want to talk about is general disengagement that we see taking place across the country, our places of work, and in our homes. We are a culture that is stirred to activism in a moment, but it's always fleeting, right? That we see a lot of outrage on social media and in communities in these little windows of time. But at the same time, we have a culture that continues to fail and to flounder because, again, we're not committed to anything long term. Actually, commitment in this generation coming up right now, the young 20s, it's not really there at all. And even in my generations, right, the 30s to 40s and stuff, we see it just fleeting more and more. And it's apathy, right? We're not giving ourselves over to things the way that God created us to do. And so what I want to talk about, again, is this general disengagement we see taking place across the country, our places of work, and in our homes. Now, apathy. Somebody I was talking to, I was like, man, I really like this series because I feel like I'm learning a new word every week. Right? For all of us that went to the little podunk country schools around here, right? It's like apathy was not one of my spelling words. So I'm going to give it to you, right? Apathy is a lack of interest, enthusiasm, or concern. Lack of interest, lack of enthusiasm, lack of concern. How many of us can agree that we see this in epidemic waves, right? Going in our school, I mean, it's everywhere, right? And it's impacted me at times. I remember my early 20s, I was so disengaged because I was a product of this culture that promised me something, and I didn't know I had to work for it. And so when I got there, I'm like, what's supposed to be taking place here? This isn't where my life's supposed to be. And so we see this disengagement, and it's gotten worse and worse over time, a lack of interest, a lack of enthusiasm, a lack of concern. The lie, right? Because we've been talking about how the enemy is leveraging these false things, this disingenuine objects, and things like that in front of us and God. So the lie here is this: there is nothing worth giving yourself for, right? Because we've made ourselves the big deal, right? We've been raised in a culture of participation trophies. We're all the main characters in our own stories, right? And if it comes to sacrifice, I sacrifice for nobody but me, right? And so there's nothing out there, that's the lie, that's worth giving what I have, my comfort, right? My pleasure. There's nothing worth giving myself to and committing myself to. There's nothing worth taking on. That's the lie. The truth, we were born to live a life of consequence. We were born and created to make waves. We were born and created to be countercultural in the things that take place out there. And God has destined us and empowered us, right, to affect change in our families, in our jobs, right? The place that we work, that we were created for a life of consequence. But the enemy wants to seep in and creep in with this lie of apathy that there's nothing worth giving yourself to. And he takes away that enthusiasm, that desire for us to move, and we settle for comfortable. We settle for status quo. We settle for the mundane, the day in, the day out, and the easy. And Jesus is saying, I've called you to more. When he came on scene, he was peaceful, he was loving, and he flipped over tables in Jesus' name, right? Just, he got after it, right? He was counter-culture, and we're called to do the same, to be bold, to stand for truth, to be loving and merciful, right? And we've leaned so much in to love and mercy that we're afraid to do anything of consequence. We're afraid to step out of comfortable. Without vision, people perish. Without vision, we get stuck. And it seems to me the hearts of a generation are perishing and that many feel there's nothing worth rousing or exciting themselves for, right? There's not this passion and this drive that I feel like I saw in my grandparents' generation, right? There was a level of commitment. There was a level of personal responsibility, not just for themselves, but for every single person in their circle, every single person they came across. There was an element of personal responsibility to affect change in their lives, to affect change in our country, to stand for something. And we lack these things, and we struggle. To quote the prophet Tyler Durden from the great documentary Fight Club, we are the middle children of history, raised by television to believe that someday we'll be millionaires, movie stars, and rock stars, but we weren't. We won't. And we're just now learning that. That was the thing that struck me across the face in my 20s. My mom had told me I could do anything. I would be anything. And I thought it would come easy because we've created a society of easy. And when this failed, I thought there was nothing. And we see this with our children today. You see it with your grandchildren today. We see it generation after generation of people who were fed a lie, a false truth, a false narrative, and they thought that was the thing. And so when the enemy pulls that away and says, gotcha, they don't realize that there was actually something great that we're called to. It just wasn't that. It wasn't money. It wasn't fame. It wasn't fortune. It was something greater. Something greater that we're called to give our lives to. The realization comes with a shock that leaves many stuck, paralyzed, drifting on autopilot. People today lack purpose. People today lack direction in their lives. People today lack initiative in relationships. People today lack a sense of vocational call. Lack, 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 lack. No initiative. No drive, no direction. The shadow of apathy standing over a generation. A lack of enthusiasm, a lack of drive, a lack of responsibility. All in order to bring us to a place of comfort so that we'll stand there and watch life pass us by while God's called us to something great and God's called us to affect change. I want to share some statistics with you. A lot of these are focused on younger generations coming up, but it's not to say it's limited to that. Because again, I see it in people in my age group and older than me. Again, I just see this kind of creeping in. We're a great country. I love our country, and God's given us something great here. But comfort is our God, and along with comfort comes apathy, and we just settle. And we haven't been called to settle. But so a lot of this is dealing with our younger generation. But today, fewer teens than ever feel an urgency to get their license. I never would have thought this until I started having, kids getting into that age group. And so we've got two 17-year-olds, another 16-year-old. And one of the three was, decently pushy. None of them were chomping at the bit like I was. Like, I turned 15 and I was like, can I get the keys to the car? And my parents were like, you don't even have a permit. I actually convinced them one time when I was 15 and a half to let me take a whole group of friends to Edgefest down at the Will Rogers Downs here. I'm like, I'm getting out of here, right? I didn't want to be at home. You couldn't nail me to the wall, right? But fewer and fewer teens are moving in this direction today. And it's the percentage of 18-year-old with a driver's license has decreased from 80.4% to 1983 to 61% in 2018. And since then, it's declined more. Less and less kids. And it's not that they're comfortable at home. If you look at demographics for home life, it's worse than ever. So it's not like they're staying because mom and dad love each other and never fight. And it's a safe place. No, more and more abuse takes place in the home. So what's keeping them there? A lack of enthusiasm, a lack of drive, lack of purpose, despair, all of these things that we've talked about the previous 6 weeks. And they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. Share this with you. More young adults than ever are failing to launch into society. And you guys are like, yeah, I knew that. The numbers are staggering though. 15.6% of young adults aged 25, say that 25 to 34, 25 to 34 live at home. And if you're in that group and you're like, that's really offensive to me. Good, man, we can come talk after service. I hope you have a good reason. Like, and maybe you do, and maybe you did what I did, and you kind of messed up for a little bit, and you had to step back in the house for a little bit. I fell into this category from addiction, but this is where people are settling, right? We used to, at one point, biblically, you had children and adults. That was God's design. And now we have children, adolescents, and adults. And you know what they're creating now? Children, adolescents, emerging adults, and adults. The emerging adults are the 20-somethings. No, you should be a man. You should be a woman. You should get out. Apathy is paralyzing an entire generation. And it's impacting us too. Don't think that it's not. You know what I see? I see parents that aren't even driving their kids to something. Why? Apathy, lack of, my dad practically booted me out. Get, boy, go do something. What are you doing? Are you going to school? Are you working? Get a place. Get out of my house. I love you. Come back on Thanksgiving, right? Then that's what we need. We have an apathetic generation of parents that aren't encouraging the kids because it's comfortable to have little Johnny at home so you can wipe his nose until he's 34. It's not what God's called us to. And we see it out there in culture impacting families, impacting communities, where we have a lack of, you know what our greatest need is out there? Men. And they're at home with mom. They're at home with mom instead of getting off the couch being men, right? Apathy has driven them there. Young marrieds are vanishing. And I'm not saying get married at 17, right? Because I have a 17-year-old daughter, and if she even brings up the word marriage, I'm going to beat her something fierce, right? That's not what I'm saying. Not what I'm saying. But young marrieds are vanishing. In 1980, the average American male married at 25 and the average woman at 22. Census data shows today the average first-time groom is 30. What are we doing? They don't want the responsibility. They cohabitate, right? Live in sin, no commitment. No commitment. And it's this apathy that drives people to this place where God has called men to be husbands, to be fathers. He's called women to be mothers, to be wives, right? We're called to these things, and apathy, the deceit from the enemy, keeps us in a place of comfort where we never step to the place of responsibility. And if we never step there, we can never affect the change that he's called us to. The shadow of apathy, again, it cripples us and paralyzes us. This was terrifying. This one. The average young person racks up 10,000 hours of gaming by the age of 21. That's almost exactly as much time as they spend in a classroom during all of middle school and high school if they had perfect attendance. That's why they're still at home at 30. Right? I mean, you know what you can learn with 10,000 hours? It's crazy. But because there's no drive, there's no push, that again, we're just content. We're comfortable. The enemy doesn't need to do anything to us other than make us be okay with where we're at. And we have men that we're raising on 10,000 hours of video game that can't change a tire, right? These people can't cook. These things, and apathy is what's got us here. 10,000 hours. There's a lack of interest in finding purpose and fulfilling calling and stepping into roles of responsibility. That's what the enemy's done. These statistics, you know what they do? Number one, they destroy nuclear families. God's called this. One of the first charges, be fruitful and multiply, right? To grow the kingdom. And he's taken away the value of marriage. He's taken away, he gave us responsibility. Tend to these things. I'm giving you dominion. And we have young people who don't want to get jobs and don't want to work. They take no responsibility. And I say young people, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, so many fall into this. And it's apathy that keeps us content. And then worse yet, maybe you get the job, you land the job, you land the wife, and you're married, but you don't invest in your marriage, right? You have the job and you're content just making money. But where's your purpose? Where's your calling? Where's your assignment? And the enemy leverages these things in our lives and blinds us to the reality and the fact that we're right where he wants us to be. And we're missing God's call. There's a lack of interest in finding purpose, fulfilling calling, and stepping into the roles of responsibility. The most effective strategy the enemy has is not to destroy us. It's to lull us to sleep with apathy. Say that again. The most effective tool that the enemy has is not to destroy our lives. It's to make us comfortable. It's to make us apathetic. It's to lull us to sleep so that we sit and do nothing. We sit and do nothing. To ease us into a sense that there's nothing to do, nothing to become, nothing to fight, to sit around and sip the sweet wine of self-pity and despair, never realizing our strength, that we're made to conquer. We're made to be adventurers. We're made to buck the broken system, not find our place in it. We're made for change, to be image bearers of a creator God, to go out there, to be living epistles and to make a ruckus out there for the things he's called us to. C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book, Screwtape Letters, and it's kind of this conversation, if you've never read it, and it's classic work, but between like the senior demon and kind of his subordinate, right? And talking about how to get somebody and get believers and things like that. It's great. It's gives a lot of insight of the ways that the enemy works, in my opinion. If you've never read it, I encourage you to read it. If you're not a reader, they've got it on audio. So C.S. Lewis, in his book, he said this, and this is part of the conversation. This is the senior demon talking to the subordinate. He says, it does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and into nothing. Murder is no better than cards if cards do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is a gradual one. The gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turning, without millstones, without signpost. Apathy is that gentle lulling that the enemy uses in our lives. Comfort, just being okay, and just being concerned about us, not rising to the greater call, awakening to who we were created to be, stepping into our identity, pursuing our purpose, finding our assignment. That's what we should be. It's what we should be after. I want to share a passage. It's a brief snippet as we look at point number one. And it was written by 1 Peter. It was in 1 Peter, written by Peter. And it says this: stay alert. Watch out for your great enemy, the devil. He prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. I believe the King James says this: looking for someone whom he may devour. And so when fighting the shadow of apathy, we need to remember this. The enemy is real, and apathy is one of his tools. That when we are stepping into comfort, the thing that we should always keep in our mind, right, is that there is actually an enemy. We forget that. When we talk about the gospel and what Jesus has done, one of the great mistakes that we do is we take out spiritual warfare and the fact that there is actually forces at work actively seeking to destroy us and to uproot our lives and to deceive us, right? And to move us in a place that's far from God, right? That's a thing. And so we need to realize this, that the enemy is real. That he is like a roaring lion prowling, looking for ways to devour you, right? That's a real thing that we have to reconcile, especially when we're talking about apathy and comfort, because when we move from the place of not believing that this is an act of work and then realizing that it is, you know what? I'm far more encouraged to push back, right? Because my fight or flight kicks in, and when I realize that there's something to fight against, I'm fighting against it, right? And if I'm convinced there's nothing there, which I believe is a great work of the enemy, right? Just to convince us he doesn't exist. If I'm convinced of that, I'll be apathetic. But if I'm awakened to the truth, I'm far more likely to be engaged. I'm far more likely to put my hands to something, to work for something, and to fight for something. And so when fighting the shadow of apathy, we need to remember the enemy is real and apathy is one of his tools. We were born on a battlefield and we were born behind enemy lines. We're not citizens of this. We make this our home. We get comfortable in it. But scripture tells us we're citizens of heaven. Every single one of us who's called on the name of Jesus, right? Who's accepted him as our Lord, as our Savior. We're foreigners here. And we were born behind enemy lines. What were we born here for? To join or to be saboteurs, right? To work behind and to see what we can do for the kingdom of God. See what we can, what kind of change we can affect and what kind of ground we can take. But we were born on a battlefield. We are in a war for our hearts and for our minds, and we give them over to 10,000 hours of gaming. My goodness. How many hours do we give, myself included, to Netflix, right? To Amazon Prime and the filth and the trash, right? That we give ourselves over to. And not all of it's bad. But how much of it brings us to this place of being apathetic about the things in our lives? Where we could invest in real change. We see the sin, we see the shortcomings, we keep hitting the same roadblocks in our marriage, and maybe we could go for some counseling, or maybe we can binge watch the latest show. And how many choose the latest show? Hasn't helped your marriage in 15 years. Probably ain't gonna start helping it anytime soon. Apathy gets us comfortable, where we'll sit on the couch night after night and we'll do that, but we won't take an hour or two a week to actually work on us, work on who we're called to be. But when you realize that there's an enemy who's trying to get you there, keep you there, not destroy your life, just make you comfortable, kick your feet up. Man, have a drink, have a cheeseburger. Man, it's okay, it's good, you worked hard. Life's busy. You don't need to do anything else. That's the place that lulls us away to our doom. If Satan can destroy your faith, if Satan can't destroy your faith, he will try to get you out of the war and into civilian affairs. Paul said this to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:2-4. He said, "Endure suffering along with me as a good soldier of Christ. Soldiers don't get tied up in the affairs of civilian life, for then they cannot please the officer who enlisted them." Again, there's an enemy. We're at war. And what we do is we mingle in civilian life. And again, it's okay. Rest, Sabbath, take some time, enjoy things. I do that. We should do that. But we've got to make investments in the fight. We can't be apathetic about everything. Again, point number one, the enemy is real and apathy is one of his tools. I want to share with you for my next few points out of the book of Nehemiah. And it parallels this thought. The book of Nehemiah, it opens in a Persian city of Susa in about 444 BC. And kind of what's taking place is the Hebrews, right, have been exiled, right? The Israelites. And Jerusalem was sacked and ravaged. And at one point, the temple was destroyed. And Ezra came and rebuilt the temple, but the city is still in ruins, and it's kind of like at the end of the time of exile, and Hebrews are starting to come back to the city, but it doesn't have walls, and in those days, like if a city didn't have walls, you were vulnerable, you know? You're not really going to be encouraged to be there because you weren't safe against threats, raiders, things like that, right? It wasn't protected. Nehemiah, he was living in exile in Persia here with the king, and he was a layman. What I mean by that is he wasn't a priest. He was actually a cupbearer. That was his job. King wanted wine. He handed the king wine, right? Not really a great thing to put on your resume. Like, what'd you do? Well, I handed somebody their drink. You know, that's just, didn't really sound that important. And that's Nehemiah, right? And it was a good job. You know, he didn't have to labor, didn't have to work hard. I'm sure he was fed well, taken care of, right? The king wanted his cupbearer. And so there's Nehemiah, and there he is. But one day he received news of the state of Jerusalem. And in Nehemiah 1:2, it says, Hananiah, one of my brothers, came to visit me with some other men who just arrived from Judah. I asked about the Jews who returned there from captivity and how things were going, right? So he's not living there, but he's asking about it. And he's talking to somebody who'd been, and this was the response. They said to me, things are not going well for those who returned to the province of Judah. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem has been torn down and the gates have been destroyed by fire. Now, there's a choice here, right? Nehemiah could lean into apathy. What can I do about it? I'm the cupbearer, right? I'm in the king's charge. It's not for me. It's for somebody else to worry about. I'm not skilled. I mean, what possibly could the bartender do in this situation? But it says, when I heard this, and this is Nehemiah speaking, when I heard this, I sat down and wept. In fact, for days I mourned, fasted, and prayed to God in heaven. So Nehemiah begins to give himself over to this, right? He decides that there's something that I can do immediately. And a lot of us need to learn this. We can't do anything right away, but we can always pray right away. And he went to prayer and he started to pray to God. And he wasn't indifferent. And he was stirred up towards it in prayer. But he didn't stop there. In chapter 2, verse 1, it said this, early the following spring in the month of Nisan, during the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, I was serving the king his wine. I'd never appeared sad in his presence. So the king asked me, why are you looking so sad? You don't look sick to me. You must be deeply troubled. Then I was terrified, but I replied, long live the king. How can I not be sad? For the city where my ancestors are buried is in ruins and the gates have been destroyed by fire. So Nehemiah carried this with him. Right? From whatever time he heard it till this early spring, right? There's a transition period where he wasn't indifferent. I would imagine he stayed in prayer. And it was something that burdened him. And then the point, he's with the king and the king notices it. And then he says this, the king asked, well, how can I help you? With a prayer to the God of heaven, I replied, if it pleases the king, and if you are pleased with me, your servant, send me to Judah. Say, send me. Send me to Judah to rebuild the city where my ancestors are buried. When fighting the shadow of apathy, we need to remember this. We need something to give our lives to. That's what we're called to, right? It's a part of our purpose and our assignment. And a part of the problem now is we don't have things that we're all in on. Right, we do pick up the bandwagon and the outrage on social media about this, that, and the other. And for 3 months, we're really ticked off and we're keyboard warriors and we'll say all the right things, but we don't give our lives to anything. And if we want to fight apathy, we have to realize that we're called to give everything to something. Your something may look different than my something, but God has purposed you. We've talked about that with the message of futility last week. You were created and purposed for something, but you're assigned to something, right? Where are you going to give your life to? What are you going to give your life to? Where are you going to get your hands dirty? And we have Nehemiah, the bartender, the cupbearer, who was burdened with something in prayer. And he said, send me. Send me to rebuild the wall. Send me to effect change. In my home, in my community, send me, was his prayer. And we need to give our lives to something if we want to push back against apathy. Nehemiah was a man who understood the importance of a call. Many of us receive the call and we hang up on God. Forget that. I won't get to play my video game. Forget that, I might have to quit my job. Forget that, I might have to commit to somebody in marriage. Or forget that, I might have to spend time with my whatever. We ignore the call and we're not willing to give our lives and take responsibility for our circle, right? And the things that God's entrusted us with. And he said, I want you to steward this, and we won't even pick it up. We're indifferent. We're content. We forget that we're supposed to be enthusiastic. And we're supposed to have purpose. We need something to give our lives to. A call, it gives us purpose and direction. It gives us strength when life is difficult, and it makes our success taste sweeter than we could ever imagine. We need something. You know, for the longest time, I was aimless. And I remember just that season of God revealing, like, that this is what you're going to do. And my assignment was I was going to pastor and I was going to teach, and that was the thing. And I've told you guys, when I got that, I had financially more stability than I've ever had. My life was so comfortable, and my life was moving in a place of greater comfort. Like, I just, it was so hard for me. And God said, no, this is not for you. And in my mind, I'm like, but God, like, you positioned me here and you brought me, and there's evidence that he did, and it was for a season, and he made me choose. Like, you can't stay here and do this. And I had to realize that God was calling me to a lifelong commitment. That this is not a job because it's good money, because it's not. It's not a job because it's comfortable and I get cush hours, because some of you people call me at like 10 o'clock at night when I'm trying to spend time with my family, and I can't even count how many times I've stepped out of my kid's birthday celebration to go deal with something. My wife can probably tell you because she's probably got it written down somewhere, right? This is not the easy way for me, but it was God's way. And I could be apathetic. I could be indifferent, where I could realize that I'm giving my life to this. I will never retire from this call. This is lifelong. I will die doing this, and I know I will. What it looks like, I don't know. And that's the thing that we gotta know, right? And understanding that and realizing that, it pulled me from a place of apathy. And I thought I was a driven person before. Man, I have never been more driven towards something when God gave me an insight that this is your life calling, that this is for you. And I've had different assignments in it. I was assigned to kids, right? He had me in that. Now currently I'm assigned to recovery, right? This is where I'm at, but it doesn't change my calling. It doesn't change what I'm supposed to give my life to. And if you want to combat that feeling of apathy and lack of enthusiasm, you got to spend time with God long enough that he reveals it to you, and then you got to be willing to set down what's comfortable, because that's probably a part of it, and get your hands dirty, right? And say, send me, God. Send me. Wherever you need me to go, send me. Send me. And that's how we push back. And that's what Nehemiah said. Send me. I don't know how. I don't know what it's going to look like, but send me. Nehemiah understood the importance of a call. So Nehemiah, he gets permission from King Artaxerxes, and he accepts the calling, and he's now no longer, he's not apathetic at all, right? He's been in prayer. He's no longer content being the cupbearer. Like, he's going to put himself in danger, and he goes to Jerusalem, and he begins to just look at everything, and almost immediately, he finds people pushing back on what he's there for, right? And he finds himself in real danger. And as we pick up in chapter 2, verse 19, it says, but when Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arab, heard of our plan, they scoffed contemptuously. What are you doing? Are you rebelling against the king? And this goes on. Threats against his life. All of these things where he had stepped out of apathy, he's in his call and his assignment, and very easily in that moment, he could say, like, never mind. I want to go back to the comfort of the palace. I want to go back to my king. I want to hold his cup until I die, because it was cush. But he didn't. He pushed back. And for over 50 days, he gathered people, gathered materials, gathered supplies, and he rebuilt the wall. And in chapter 6, verse 1, it says, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies found out that I had finished rebuilding the wall and that no gaps remained, though we had not yet set up the doors in the gates. So Sanballat and Geshem sent this message asking me to meet them in one of the villages in the plain of Ono, but I realized that they were plotting to harm me. So I replied. Say, I replied. This is so important. Man, this is something I have to remind myself of often when the enemy seeks to disrupt me. So I replied by sending this message to them. I am engaged in a great work, so I cannot come. I'm engaged in a great work, so I cannot come. Why should I stop working to come meet with you? When fighting the shadow of apathy, We need to remember we must discipline ourselves to see it through. We've got to be engaged in a great work. And you can't say that unless you found it, right? You got to know what your purpose to. You got to begin to give your life to it. But when you find it, this is the level of commitment we need, right? To know and to reconcile in our heart, I'm engaged in a great work. I'm going to see this through. I know who my God is. I know who I am in him. And no matter what comes against me, I'm going to keep pushing through. I'm engaged in a great work, right? And we've got to know that inside of us. Otherwise, apathy will come back. It'll rear its ugly head. It'll seek to lull you to comfort on that great wide road to hell. We must discipline ourselves to see it through. I've told you guys about first stepping into ministry and financial trouble, the things that I faced and how hard it was. One of the things that I've never shared up here in regards to that is as I'm going through this, I'm looking at getting sued, losing everything. I'd been dishonest with my wife. Life was a mess. That first year, I stepped out of graphic design, signs, those things. And I've shared this privately with people before in counseling, but a little bit into it, a lady for the company I used to work for, she had bought it and she had it and she decided she didn't want to deal with it anymore. And I'd went and tried to help her out a little bit just out of kindness, didn't ask for anything. But she said, do you want this? And this was a thriving business, been around for like over 2 decades, made money. She said, I shouldn't have bought this. I shouldn't have bought this. I just went out from under it. I'll carry the note. You don't even have to go to the bank. Like, this is yours. I mean, it would have completely changed all the circumstance, right? I stepped into ministry. I'm floundering. Part of my mind is saying, clearly I made a mistake. I didn't hear God right. This was supposed to be easy. I'm not supposed to be getting sued. And I had to pray about it. And I had to realize I'm engaged in a great work. And unfortunately for me, that great work was not taking that business. And I'll say one of my buddies did it, and he's thriving. He's doing pretty good. Sometimes I just want to, you know, talk to him about how jealous I am. And, you know, like, hey, she asked me first, buddy. I don't know if you know that, you know. But I'm engaged in a great work. And it looked good. And it looked like a God thing. And it wasn't until years later that I could see why the enemy was so actively trying to discourage me with this golden calf type of thing, right? Oh, come, life will be good. Life will be easy. You'll pay all your bills. You can be the husband you wanna be, the father you wanna be. You can take care of your family financially. It'll be great. But I was engaged in a great work. Doesn't stop there. Less than 2 months later, another friends of mine, they own an established business unrelated to that. Has nothing to do with it. They weren't satisfied with the way things were going initially with that. The business they used to do business with, another business had shut down, same type of market. They saw an opportunity and they came to me. Aaron, man, you do great work. I'd been in the industry for a long time. And they said, we'll be silent partners. Like, we'll give you everything you need. Let's start back up, get re-engaged. We have a great opportunity here. Now, first time, that wasn't from God, but second time, surely this is God trying to send a message to me, right? And I had to pray about it. I'm facing lawsuits. I may lose my home. I'm engaged in a great work, and it wasn't that. And I had to double down. Third time, kid you not, same year, another business owner in town, great friend of mine, done business with him for years, had an empty lot. He said, I own that lot. I'm looking to build something on it, and I will fund everything you need if you open your doors back up. I'm engaged in a great work. I had to know. I had to know what I was called to do. I had to go back and say, God, I think you asked me to give my life to this, not this. And because I knew, right? I knew that I'd given my life to him in ministry and that this didn't fit. I knew and it was made it so much easier to know that this looks great. This looks good, but that's not God. That's not God, and we must discipline ourselves to see it through because not every attack of the enemy is to destroy you. Some are to lull you into comfort. What if I'd done that? What would this look like? I don't know. What would Live Free exist? I don't know. What things would the enemy have pulled me away from, pulled my family away from, where there's generational change taking place that I get to have my hands on, that God uses me to do? What would be different if I'd taken the path of apathy and allowed him to lull me to sleep on my way to hell? I'm engaged in a great work. No, find what you're called to give your life to and be committed to seeing it through. I want us to do this. I want us to bow our heads, close our eyes. I want you to spend a moment with him. And I want you to, first, I want you to ask him to search you. Say, God, am I apathetic? Lord, am I just living in comfort? Lord, am I scared to move? Am I scared to be uncomfortable? Just ask him, God, reveal it to me. Where am I at? And then, no matter what, I mean, ask him, Lord, show me. Begin to speak to me. And it's not going to be a one and done prayer. You got to commit to it. It may be years, but you've got to commit to, God, what are you calling me to give my life to? Lord, where am I going? Where would you have me to go in this? And just begin to spend time with him beyond today, every week, asking him those questions. Lord, am I trapped in apathy? And what would you have me give my life to? God, am I stuck and comfortable? What would you have me give my life to? Spend a moment with him in prayer.